Well, thank you all for coming. Probably should leave the door open so people can wander in and out, I suppose. Well, I'm kind of a renegade in scientific circles, I suppose, to a degree. I just gave a talk to the Cal Poly Physics Department on Thursday, and I tease them on how politically incorrect, because in physics you don't talk about consciousness, you're ostracized, and I said all the standard models weren't sufficient, so you're ostracized if you do that kind of thing too. So I suppose the politically incorrect thing here is that we already have the theology and the Doctrine and Covenants thing, all spirit is matter and stuff like that. You know, and that's fine if you want to get some revelation, but if you want to use that to build an automobile, or you have to put in some science. So I'll use as little science as I can. I'll keep it as conceptual as I can, but. Unfortunately, we have this gulf between science and theology about the time of Galileo, and a lot of it's the theologians' time is the part they were at the time. They were kind of very stubborn and everything, but they aren't mutually exclusive. It's an end of a long continuum, and now the time is coming to integrate them again. Maybe part of my premise is a little bit prophetic almost. I'm claiming that. This is God's church and this is where the Savior is going to rule from, that Mormon theology should be more and more central to world epistemology. And that's not really, if I'm wrong in that somehow, I don't have it complete, it doesn't really spoil the other main thesis, but, because it's hard to imagine right now, we only have a couple percent of the world's population is the church. What is it going to take for the world to suddenly, Mormonism is the thing they ought to be studying? But I also think that part of this is, we had one Mormon who was kind of involved in the invention of television and something like that, but I'm going to claim to be one of the discoverers of consciousness. And that seems like an oxymoron, but Newton got credit for discovering gravity because he defined it in a certain way. So we're kind of all infested with consciousness, but... So in the time to come after this, if what I say is true, and I've already partially designed devices... I'm going to be able to build these devices. I'm going to be able to improve this empirically. But today I'm going to just give you a flavor for that, and I'm going to give you a flavor for what the universe is like. There's one of the books out there, I think, has an interesting article on can Mormon theology survive the Big Bang? Because the Big Bang is Darwinian evolutionary, and it doesn't have any cause and something like that. So, but of course, if we have enough faith, well, now the Big Bang, even though there's people around say, well, it's impossible the Big Bang is wrong, we're going to come with a new model that goes kind of beyond which is God's universe. Now I've drawn my theory mostly from the Doctrine and Covenants, and I'm not going to spend too much time with those scriptures because you're all are or should be familiar with them. One like I mentioned, all spirit is matter, some of the other ones especially are interesting, that, for example, that an angels fly through the midst of heaven, and that's the reason for gravitation. So we have, in both Eastern and Western theology, some people say that gravitation is caused by the movement of spirit. And the first thing we have is we have the Holy Ghost as the framer of the heaven. The thing is the spark of life, the old Elan Vital, vital force, which is kind of cast out of science currently, and the light of our mind. So because in Mormonism those things are physical, that Holy Ghost is a true light, like the light of the sun. It's a physical light. It's bosonic or photonic, as they would say more in scientific circles. So that puts me maybe 20 years ahead of the rest of the scientific community on that part, and if I have time to mention, most 93% of scientists today think that what processes in the brain give rise to mental life. And those of us here who believe in God, we know there's a little more to us or to the mind and the brain. So they can't even hope to solve the problem. And most of them are saying, well, it's going to be 500 or 1,000 years, if ever. Then the Eastern schools of thought say, well, they go into this, they meditate into this spiritual monism, and they have experience. Well, that's ineffable, and that's immaterial, so consciousness can't be defined. So I have all that against me to start in formulating a theory, number one, and then in proclaiming that I've actually discovered it. Now, here's the first thing of part of the reason, and I'm not going to argue with Einstein here. Einstein said all of physics is based on two measuring rods. One is that of duration, and the other is that of extension. That seems reasonable. And but I'm going to argue with the interpretation of that. This is used. So first of all, when I go to like the physics department and say, well, we need to throw out all the physics, I tease them, and of course that gets their attention. But when Einstein falsified Newtonian mechanics, we didn't throw that away. There's an interesting thing. One of the famous scientists, Misner, who wrote a lot of books, says when a theory is falsified, it becomes an absolute truth. So Newtonian mechanics is an absolute truth in that domain that it describes. If you're going to fire a bullet or do a rocket, it's not a relativistic rocket approaching the speed of light, but our normal rocketry, Newtonian theory is still used for that. It's an absolute truth in that domain. And we're now going to be getting ready to falsify Einsteinian general relativity, so that will become an absolute truth. It's a very good theory in the domain it describes, but if you follow the news, there's these big debates about is there a quantum gravity, and general relativity doesn't, two things it doesn't do, it doesn't describe things at the small scale or at the highest level of the cosmos. Why does a galaxy not spin like a phonograph record? It spins, all of it spins at the same speed. So that's a big problem. Einstein's general relativity doesn't describe that. The other thing, that's where they get all this dark matter. One of the reasons is there can be dark matter. They can't find the dark matter. I may not have time to go into that too much. So the problem here is that we're made out of and embedded in these measuring rods. So, and we started out as existing for almost a year in a bag of water. And then we grew up out with our minds kind of wiped clean. So we don't remember. You know, we put on virtual reality glasses, we come back and see, oh, that's not the real reality. But this all looks so real to us because, you know, it's been built into us. But I'm going to claim that this is just the virtual reality. One of the first people 2,000 years ago to say this was the Greek philosopher Plato. He said that reality is like us being in a cave, chained up facing the wall, and there's a light behind us, and this view of reality is just like the images on the wall. And if you do happen to break away from it, first you're blinded by that light, and then later you might see it, but it's hard to describe that. I've modernized it to a certain degree, or where I add some more physical features to Plato's thing, where we have, if this little section here symbolizes a snapshot of our... In Newtonian mechanics, we just had three dimensions. Einstein gave us a fourth dimension. The model of the universe that I'm going to tell you about later, probably briefly, has 12 dimensions. And the logic for deducing that is that, which I'll tell you a little bit more about later, is this is called a Minkowski space-time package, is the terminology that's used. So I claim that we need three of those to make up this bigger reality. So this guy, if he wipes out, he's dead. He's not. The brain isn't relevant to our consciousness other than it's a transducer that gets this external reality into the real spiritual part of our consciousness. That's a hard thing for scientists today to accept. And you know, it manages our physiology. You know, because they'll claim, you know, if you're knocked unconscious, well, you know, they think that's so important. Well, it just means that there's been a little block in that input. But here, and time, as I'll show you later, is built in. In the Big Bang, time originated in some 20 billion years ago, but in the model that I'm going to tell you about, time comes out of the vacuum structure, and this is going to be one of the ways, this is one of the things that makes my theory falsifiable. I've designed some experiments to prove it. So we're made of, all of this is what we're made out of. We don't see this because something in the nature of our soul that allows us just to see this part of it. We can't... Actually, I have a little blurb I'll come to, and maybe I have that over here. Let's see. I think it's kind of fun to read. Where is it? If I could turn my head at the speed of light, I could see into next Tuesday or last Thursday. The thing that I'm going to... In science, we have the uncertainty principle. You can only do either position or momentum at the same time. You can't do both. And that's part of this. But as you may... this package of reality, but as you may have heard talk about higher dimensions, or if you're in flatland, somebody in a fourth dimension can see right into you. So there's only two part kinds of matter in the universe. One is bosons or light type, and one is fermions or solid type matter. So I'm going to claim that the uncertainty principle only applies to Fermi particles, and if you had a bosonic access, you could see into the megaverse where God lives, or you could see a lot of the rest of this other structure. So if I turn my head at the speed of light, I could see into some of these things. But my head is already turning at the speed of light. At the fundamental quantum mechanical level, all those particles are in a dance of annihilation and creation, which is occurring at the speed of light. So it's the coherent superposition of my mind, this ball of light, which is part of my soul that I need to rotate at the speed of light. But normally I can't do this either. And this is my point. With God's help, meditation or revelation, we can kind of do that. Because our consciousness is a thing called coupling. If I put a magnet near this, there's kind of a coupling of that energy. So because we're in the last frame, because we're made of and embedded in all of this, we're coupled to this reality. We can't easily escape from it unless God gives us a revelation or we through some kind of meditation or insanity or drugs or something not recommended, break a little bit of the gap. So it looks like, and a lot of people, I'm not going to give you any of the technical parts of any of this. I guess we'll forget. But the universe is really has some kind of a big holographic structure. You know, in the Doctrine and Covenants says all things are before God. So if you use this kind of as the three aspects of our reality, length, width, and height, for example, there's other threefold things that you could take. If you focus on one, or if God focuses on one, that's the one that's brought to his focus. But he could pick any of these infinite ones, and that would instantly, he wouldn't have to go anywhere, instantly that portion of that reality. So time, moving around in time, becomes like the pages of the book. If this page is that one surfer guy, God, or if you're in a revelatory state, can get any of the whole things just by this being a higher dimensional structure. At the speed of light, we know that we're going to have light in our veins instead of blood. That's going to make us more light-like creatures. According to general relativity, all lengths contract to zero, time contracts to zero. So they say, if you could follow a light beam, you could circumnavigate the whole universe with no time. This gives us a hint of what God's realm is like. So a hologram, if you may know about that, if I rip out any piece, if I take a normal photograph, if I rip out any piece, then my head is missing or something else. But a hologram has all of the information in all of it, except it's just slightly dimmer. It's like, So it looks like the megaverse has properties of a hologram, only not just the little sheets that we have. It's a kind of a dynamic hologram. You know, the holograms we take are a piece of film. But if you can imagine a dynamic hologram and one that's called a depth hologram, if a depth hologram, you focus, you can take a microscope or something and focus on any part, say if it was in a crystal itself. They're now going to use these in computers. Holographic memory will have things 100,000 times bigger than the drives we have now, and they'll just be a little cube because... with light, I don't know how far they've come with the ones they're going to release next year, but you can just focus on any part of that, the same as you would do here, and you can have... So data is going to become less and less of a problem, but the universe... the big universe is not a conscious universe. Quantum theory came along. In Newtonian mechanics, conscious was irrelevant. Quantum theory came along, we had this observer. It's caused more problems than it has, but that's as far as we've come in consciousness into the standard model so far. In the standard model, the Big Bang models, when they discovered these, I don't need the commentary on this. The people have said, well, those higher dimensions, you know, Einstein gave us four dimensions. Now they say, well, maybe there's 10 or 11. These extra six or seven dimensions are curled up at the Planck scale, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, in these little balls. That's what the current standard models say. But in the noetic, I call this the continuous state conscious universe. Instead of it being a subspace of us, this is just the hypercube of four dimensions. You can see the regular kind of cube in here, but the higher dimensionality of it. So this could be equated with the Hubble sphere, which is the observational limit of our reality. We're a subspace of God's megaverse. Another way of looking at that is you can see... forget the commentary. I'm sorry. You can see this is just the four-dimensional cube, but it has a three-dimensional cube inside it. And so you can see that our reality, this is just a metaphor to conceptually see that our reality can be a subset of the higher reality. Of course, if this is only four dimensions, if the real universe relative to us is 12 dimensions, it's a little more complex. So the Klein bottle is a higher dimensional structure. This is actually too primitive. There'd be something maybe called a Calabi-Yau structure, something like that. But it gives you the idea. This is, you start at the outside of this, you can end on the inside. So this, for example, could be our Hubble sphere and the real universe, that computer color thing that I showed you. There's room for an infinite number of of Hubble spheres. And we say, it's God says it, or Joseph Smith says it in the Doctrine and Covenants, there's no space in which there is no kingdom. And so, well, does that mean there can be another universe right here? Yes. Because if things go 90 or 180 degrees out of phase, they can pass in curves that don't even touch us. This is in general wave mechanics, even primitive things. So this whole, all the space can be occupied. And of course, in a conscious, you can see how that makes things very efficient for God. And, you know, that maximizes the use of every space. And if it's a conscious universe, and he can afford a higher dimensional being, can see right inside of us, you know, I can't see and decide when they tell me or they cut open their head. All right, so one of the things, physics hasn't liked this in the past because they thought it made things too ordered. If we take the model of space-time, which actually began in 1945 with Wheeler and Feynman, says that the present, and this could be drawn as a three-dimensional cube or a hypercube, whatever, the present is continuously created out of the future past. And that makes sense. If our temporal reality is a four-dimensional structure surfing on the face of eternity, this is, it seems obvious, just conceptually, this is the kind of thing that you would get. So then you can see, and I guess I'll go on to the next one. I have a little more complex metaphor. I'm standing on the opposite side, so my dyslexic nature, it's taking me an extra... So I should redo this figure to have more four-dimensional things like this and draw it off the scale. But, and there's a question, this is about causality. But there's this thing about the pilot waves. So in a sense, you have kind of two kinds of causality. One that kind of orders this so that there can be... The other thing about this, there's enough degrees of freedom to handle God's universe and have ours be embedded in it. This is mandatory for my model of consciousness and proving my theory, because I have to, if this structure didn't exist, I'm going to have to violate the uncertainty principle to question. There's a couple of more things to this. In the Big Bang, it says compactification, those little circles of dimensions, occurred, you know, 20 billion years ago, whatever, and they're all locked into this fabric of reality, which is a rigid, fixed Newtonian structure. It's immutable. In my model, compactification is a continuous process. The higher dimensional, 12-dimensional structure continuously in little cycles of annihilation and creation goes down. This would be the Planck point. There's, you know, any metaphor is incomplete, but you would see that the structure goes, because I have it going this way, goes from a point. And so this is a continuous process as the present, which is locked in like a standing wave on a violin. You use this, you know, it's hard for people at first glimpse to first accept that this reality can be a facade, number one. But if you think of it as a movie, going to the movies, the reality looks very smooth. To the projector, it's this little series of frames. You already know, I'm sure, about the quantum mechanics at the basis of reality. So there's plenty of room inside each of those frames for all this hyperdimensional activity to go on. And effects can affect free agency a little bit. Our thinking and our neural processes in time, you know, God has no time at the speed of light with no time. So in the process, we're just beginning to do something, even if it's a billionth of a nanosecond. God has enough time to be omniscient. That's only part of the thing of trying to explain free agency. It's a little more complicated than that. So space-time is kind of a structure like this, where I have another Necker cube. These vertices, it's called topological switching. So there's another way. This is part of how the dimensional reduction occurs without actually even any energy, because this vertice can be a distant vertice or the focus vertice. And this thing in gravitational occurs called parallel transport. So there's all these things. And if this is, let's say, the length dimension, when it goes into the next level of reduction, it can become a bit or actually a time dimension, because E equals mc squared applies not only to matter but also to space-time. And that's one of the things about that. I think I'm coming to another... I don't know if this one helps a little bit. I know, I'm used to standing on the other side, and then I put it the... This also relates to the issue of whether the photon has mass. And the photon is made of electromagnetic radiation. They come they come, the electric, it's an oscillation of the electric and the magnetic, they come to together at a place, that I call that the particulate moment, and that's when the photon couples to the vacuum. So it's the mass, instead of in traditional theory always being zero, it goes, it has a little bit of mass, and it goes back to zero, so that oscillates as it couples to the vacuum. That's also a very critical part of this theory, and it's one of the things that is going to allow me to violate the uncertainty principle. The universe... maybe I should skip some of this other complex stuff enough. But the universe, this is a view of the universe. Material objects are made out of molecules and then atoms and nucleons. Nucleus made out of nucleons. And we get down and you've probably heard of quarks. And quarks are just are made out of things, little spinning things in space-time. And then you get into, Einstein said all of physics is geometry. We get into this geometry and gravitation. Over here, it hasn't been as easy. There's still, we didn't really get the concept of the photon until Einstein. So I'm having to redefine the photon because I want to integrate gravity with it to get that God's spirit being ruling the universe. So it has to have a photonic basis. This is another place where that where the 12 dimensions comes in. Normally a photon is a dipole. And there's some historical basis for the quadrupole. But then I use three units. So I get kind of this photon-graviton complex. You'll see some of the relevance more in a moment, I hope. And this also becomes part of spinners, and it gets down to gravitation again. And I should continue this diagraph later on and get, in the next time I redo it, to get into the megaverse. You know, I'm saying that there's a possibility for an infinite number of Hubble spheres in God's universe. I would draw one circle here, which would be ours, and they can all be embedded like in a Klein bottle in the rest of them. This is just a better view of the photon-graviton. So... A number of years ago, people, great physicists in the last 50 or 100 years have tried to do this and they failed. The time just wasn't right. I'm sure they were 10 times as smarter than I am, but they didn't have the space-time structure and stuff which is required to do it. So I had to do a lot of work in the nature of space-time. Luckily, I have a famous physicist in Paris, Jean-Pierre Vigier, which is very interesting between the two of us. I think we're going to be able to do that. So there's a Nobel Prize for that one. When they were introducing me to Cal Poly, they asked me, what do you want me to say about it? He goes, Nobel Prize. So during the talk, I teased everybody, and I said, well, here's the 12 places where I could win a Nobel Prize, and hopefully I could win at least one of them. I think I'll skip over this one. This is the four standard models of our science at the moment, and I say all these are insufficient. In physical science, it's run by empiricism. If you don't do the experiment, it doesn't exist. It's not part of science. You can get away with some of it by having a good mathematical theory that has some rigor. And in philosophy and theology, even though we can know the truth, science hasn't really gotten to a place of having empirical metaphysics yet. So this doesn't really help science because it's we can be satisfied as Mormons by the feel of the truth, but you can't build a projector with that feel of the truth very easily. But it can. The one thing it can do. So this is back again about me. I call myself a noeticist. It was defined by Plato. He said, noetic insight is the highest form of knowing because no matter how smart you are, no matter what you know, noetic insight comes beyond yourself. It's kind of like a revelation from God. So the other thing about noetics is a complete epistemology. It integrates the rigor and empiricism of physical science, the logic of philosophy, and the absolute truth of theology. So I've sat with very brilliant men from time to time around a table having a problem, and they'll go logically. They're geniuses. Every logical path to solving the problem. That's all they can do with the logic and wisdom of their mind. And maybe there's 100 or maybe there's 20 paths and they'll divide it up or which seems the most promising path to devote the rest of our life to. But if I use revelation from God, I can narrow it down, those 100 paths down to 2 or 3 paths maybe. All right, so I've just saved millions of dollars and millions of man hours in being able to do that. This group is trying to reject reductionism, but all of these are, except for the 7% who are, this is the driving force of consciousness. It's called consciousness studies. It's a very new field, started in 1994. All of these are really brain things, emerging from the brain, embodied in the brain, neural network stuff, some kind of new, and then there's a computational, of course. Physical can kind of go in a lot of places. So I'm kind of way off here. People scoff now. Descartes. He was the founder of dualism, res cogitans and res extensa, mind substance and body substance. he's considered now ludicrous, especially when he says, well, he divined that as a revelation from God. People don't want to hear that. But if you've ever heard the story of Nasruddin, his friend comes to visit him. He's out in front of his house under the streetlight looking for something. He says, what are you looking for? My keys. And he starts helping him for a while. He says, well, where'd you live? In the backyard. Why are you looking over here? Well, it's my life. So we have all these people. Everybody thinks that cognitive science is a very popular thing. Oh, it's got to be the brain. So they're all, and David Chalmers, who my critic over here has heard of, he was launched to fame at this 1994 Tucson Conference because he said, that what is the fundamental unit in existence where we should formulate a theory of consciousness? And you can think of, we kind of got stuck on the five senses when that was defined by, was it Aristotle or somebody? But there's really a lot more, more to senses. But the point I want to make is, all of these senses, like wheels and spokes, come into our being, the sense of awareness. They're all parts of the sense of awareness. So Chalmers said, awareness is the fundamental entity with which to formulate a theory of consciousness. That's fine. Don't argue with that. That's great. But then he went on to say, what properties in the brain give rise to this awareness? So right away we have a category error for philosophy of mind. And even Chalmers unwittingly says, well, this is a hard problem. He says the easy problems are so difficult that you can hardly research them. The hard problems are almost impossible. So he's defined a way of trying to search for consciousness that nobody, especially the 93% of the cognitive science, are going to be able to do, because by definition, it can't be done. And so isn't that interesting? My theory, we'll get into my theory a little bit now. I call it noetic field theory after Plato. I love this Greek term for mind. It's the core of all the theories. There's about 8 or 9 viable theories. The one that's the most fun is the artificial intelligence one. If we just knew the right algorithm for the right program, we could duplicate all of human intelligence right now on the computers we have today. And these people are so narrow-minded and go so far to say, as a thermostat is conscious because it has a bipolar state. Okay, well, you know, you can solve the spurious past, they get run down and don't. Then people get, you know, a little bit better. The brain certainly is processing a lot of information. And they say that there's these neural networks in the brain which are computer-like, and they'll try to find computer-like structures into the neural structures of the brain. You know, and that's good. And then people go either through those neural networks, or there's people say in the microtubules. A microtubule is a part of every nerve, and it's the place where you start to see quantum effects in the brain. So quantum theory is very popular. So we have a number of quantum theories of the brain coming out of that. I think I have a picture of a microtubule. A very famous brain scientist, Carl Pribram, called it the holographic theory. And then fairly soon after that, they said, well, Carl, if there's a hologram in the brain, doesn't the laser burn a hole in the skull? So his theory, it's really a fabulous theory, but his detractors did so much damage to that. Then he called it the holonomic theory. But it actually, he's discovered holographic-like properties in the brain where something over here, you can get diffuse information there, so it's really, and he's, through the help of some other people, brought it into the quantum realm. He has, the Schrodinger equation is the main equation of quantum theory. He has a neural wave equation, which has very similarities to that equation. And now he's finally, in his old age, gotten a little bolder, and he calls it quantum holography. So he's kind of gotten, he doesn't care anymore about his detractors. The microtubules have two states, two protein states. These are called pericrystalline oligomers, one with an electron and one without. So it just kind of oscillates. So if you remember that the little dots going by, you can see you can get information processing going on there. And this is actually quite a highly developed theory. Roger Penrose, a very famous physicist from Britain, and Stuart Hameroff. This would be these tubulin dimers here, and one would say you have the electron and one doesn't. It's ran the way to do it. And there's electric effects here. Okay. And it's called a chasm of radius. The radius within the microtubule is big enough for a photon to get through. So there's room for God's spirit things in this model. And then there's some Japanese people who it goes back to the 60s, a fellow named Frohlich, who said that there's kind of quantum coherence in the brain. And then he had some descendants, Umezawa, I probably forget about the names at the moment, but these Jabu and Yasuo are the major proponents of this quantum brain dynamics theory. and it has these Goldstone bosons or corticons, which are types of photons that exist in all the stuff in the brain. So I have all these hooks which allow me to integrate my theory into all of these. Another very similar thing, Sir John Eccles, the last great duelist, and I've been asked to take over for him. He says that there's a similar type of thing is happening at the synapse. And he was a biologist, and he had a physicist, so they use tunneling at the synapse. You kind of get these all or none or gradients through tunneling that can fire a synapse. It's not just a linear. Eccles had an idea, he called it the psychon. That was God's little thing. And the psychon hooked up to a thing called the dendron. A dendron is a bundle of dendrites. The dendrites are some of the big neural structures in the brain. And you can look at his publications if you want to look more on that. So that's most of the theories. There's another one called category theory, which is a beautiful method. It can describe anything. That's one of the newest ones. And that will all of the disciplines pretty much of science have become kind of modernized, except for philosophy. It's still very classical. And so it's had trouble trying to get a logic of practical reason or intentionality. This category theory probably has the ability to kind of get around that. Then my theory comes along, and we have this tertiary domain. Here's where everybody else is working, and then the people get down to the quantum level. But I go down, when I did this a few years ago, I used Roger Penrose's work, because he had these things about twisters. So I get down to this elemental intelligence, which is in God's realm, and call it the megaverse. And so I have three aspects to the theory. One is elemental intelligence is the most difficult to find. It's kind of this is the eternal boundary condition of our intelligence. And then the rest of this is the pathways of the Holy Ghost to integrate the two into this threefold nature. Another way of looking at that is kind of like this. And this also ties in metaphorically to my three Minkowski space-time units. These other two, at every moment, we don't see it because it's all fed into each other like a standing wave in a violin string, but you need the non-local domain, the quantum or the mega unitary domain and the megaverse and all of these. And that part, this is in the, you won't see this clear, but in that dimensional reduction, recreation, all this is very important of how the God's universe fits into ours. This model also gives, if you want to say Jung's collective unconscious is real. We appear as separate individuals, it's called locally, but non-locally, in that whole hyperdimensional hologram, we're really connected. So this I will use as a basis to be able to explain telepathy, and there'll be devices to be able to use to do this, and a lot of diseases will, because there is this connection, because there is a gravitational connection, they even realize it. But we can have a system, if you could latticize this, you could imagine, and they've already found this in the Johns, a famous neuroscientist, said, well, there's NR things that easily show something like an alcoholism, depression, and you're going to get structures that it's very primitive still at the beginning of this, but one of the other ways, so instead of only giving people drugs, we'll be able to balance these fields of the tensions between employers and workers and husbands and wives and family members. And you get born also with the structure, which, why does a certain disease run in your family, but it's not really genetic? Because you have an energetic pattern. I talked about coupled, like at every little point, at every little atom and molecule, Talmage and Jesus the Christ, the one-liner said, the consciousness of the atom. Well, in this model, there's an element of consciousness that is the conscious universe, even in the atom. So it has one. Plants may have two. Human beings have three. So it all goes up to the whole. This is just a hint of the flavor of this. So all these things are coming. Just so you know, I have a minimal amount of credibility. This fellow, I'm going to Romania in June, and they're going to elect me as an honorary member of the Romanian Academy, says, the most advanced theory is the noetic theory of Richard Amoroso. So it's out of the mouth of two witnesses. When I went to Slovenia a number of years ago, I gave two talks. Me and this Kyle Preburn, who is very famous. I hope some of you have heard of him. We were the only two English-speaking or Americans there, and I was flattered they paid me as much as him. I gave my talk the first day, and the second day, these three professors came up to me, Professor Amoroso, we were up all night. We couldn't sleep. We spent the whole night talking about your theory. We know it's going to be taught in the school. And so just another little biographical So those three states, I can make them into an equation. This is a simple linear sum equation. When you expand it nonlinearities, this is the wave function of the mind. This is the elemental intelligence, the cosmological ordering principle, which relates to the spirit, and this is the brain as a Fermi apparatus. So that one, when I expand that, I can get into some very complicated things. Now, in 2 minutes, I'm going to try to derive for you my E equals MC squared, which I hope eventually I'll win the Nobel Prize for. We start with, maybe, I hope you've all heard of Newton's force. This is how a bullet works. A force on a mass creates some kind of acceleration. It's a very, if you haven't ever studied any science, you've never heard of this, but it's a place to start. It's a very simple equation. And everyone, I'm pretty positive, has heard of E equals MC squared. So I substitute this into Newton's equation because I don't want the mass in there at the moment. So I get the energy relation. Then, I don't know why I have this here at the moment. It's not the one that I wanted. Then I want to get rid of, I want to do something with the acceleration. And this part is a little more complex, and I'll have to skip through it a little bit in the interest of time. But I want to put this in a conscious universe. A friend of mine, he worked out this thing, and it's interesting, like Copernicus, he had this in his drawer for 30 years. Finally, I got after him, and he finally published it, and because of that, I got my name on it also, and it's in a book that came out last year. C is the speed of light. R, this relates to the Hubble. R is a dot is a derivative, so if you know mathematics, you get, it's the rate of change. So the rate of change of length of the time is related to the speed of light, C. The Hubble radius, the expanding universe, is supposed to be going at the speed of light. So you have the rate of change of the radius is this derivative over time. So we can make up a term for the acceleration in terms of the Hubble constant. And then if I resubstitute it back in, I get my force equation, E equals C squared A, and I put the C squared because of C equaling R, I can cancel out the C squares, and I get this simple equation. The noetic force of consciousness is equal to the energy over the radius. Now, this may seem trivial, but this is actually a very profound equation. I'm going to be able to expand this and do anything with it. I put this into my other equations, and I would, there is a place to do it related to brain things, but I would use the Schrodinger equation. This radius isn't a simple radius. It's like an angular momentum. It can be related to gravitational. There's a torsion in gravitational theory. So it's a more complex radius. But if you've seen Einstein's gravitational theory, G equals 8 pi T. But when you expand that, he couldn't solve it. It took I forgot the fellow's name at the moment. It took him 3 years or something to solve it. So this gets very complex also. This is a very, I love this term because, number one, there's a thing in physics called the gion. Wheeler, he said, you can imagine a ball of photons so big that it has enough gravitational mass to cohere into a ball. But now, this was a hypothetical classical construct. He didn't really find any, maybe there's something like a star, maybe we'll find that later. But he did this, 50 years ago. But now, I say God's realm is a hyperdimensional gion. We know it's a light thing. There's going to be some spatial properties to it. But imagine God's realm is a hyperdimensional gion. All it is light energy. So that light energy in this scalar-variant process from the megaverse down in is this ball of light. And this whole structure that I have, there's a couple of important points. And is my clock here? Is it only 20
up? We're on a different clock.
Okay. Okay, so we're not too far out. And then, all right, yes, all right, we're going to do some time to question. Einstein, because of he knew he was going to win the Nobel Prize. I think he promised it to his ex-wife, well, I'll give you the Nobel Prize winning. Of course, he didn't get it from anybody he thought it was. It was for the photoelectric effect. So because of that, they've named a physical constant after him. It's called the Einstein. And it's a very curious constant. Nobody's been able to use it for anything, but now I've found the place that it should be used. And Einstein is a mole of photons, an Avogadro's number of photons, 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd photons is a mole of photons. So, if this equation can be part of the whole conscious universe, from the macro down to the micro to the smallest, if this will help define a fundamental conscious energy, the smallest one known at the moment is a prion, I can begin to try to use this in a prion. It'll be an easy place to start. Say, well, how much? Now, this isn't the kind, because this is a force, it's not like a gravitational force. I'm not going to use this for telekinesis. This is the light. This is a different kind of a force, really. One of the other key things I didn't say is I wondered for a long time. I haven't been able to do this because I didn't know if consciousness was a fifth force or was an integration of some of the other four forces. It turns out the consciousness is an integration of gravity and electromagnetism. So it's an electromagnetic, a gravity electromagnetic force, and that's where we have that graviton complex and all the stuff and all. It's a beautiful term. So that's what this force is, a very subtle form, as you can imagine. But because of the couplings in light paths, this gets almost like acupuncture theory. If you shut down one of the light paths, you're going to have some problems in some part of your body. It's very subtle. You know, unless you meditate or something, you're not even going to know it. The obvious thing to have that's very simplistic for this equation, if you meditate, you focus your mind, this radius is smaller, you have more energy. So that's almost a trivial thing, but it's just one little thing that may, well, maybe this wise ass, his equation works a little bit. But you can see that it does. But anyway, I'm going to blow the world, the thing out in quantum computing. I managed to get myself as the chairman of a quantum computing conference that Feynman started. So I have a bulk quantum computer. I haven't been able to do it. I have a methodology for making a bulk quantum computer. That's very important because it's the core of a thing I call the cerebroscopic transducer. They've found some implants that can make deaf people hear. Because of that work, they said, well, maybe why can we do something with vision? So now they're going to put a silicon chip in, but only 10-15% because you need a viable optic nerve. Because of this higher dimensional stuff, I'm going to be able, through resonance, build a cerebral transducer and would take a hook of a video camera and put vision right into a person's mind. All kinds of other, and it bases on, the proof of this is, so that's just one of the devices. One of the more fun ones that you'll like is a thing called the telecerebroscope, where you'll be able to hook yourself up to it and videotape your thoughts. Or if I'm in love with somebody here, you go to China, we'll be able to communicate through this device, because in the non-local arena we're connected. The one final note on the proof, at the quantum level, the universe looks very stochastic. And the origin of stochasticity. If my model is correct, behind that wall of uncertainty is this higher dimensional realm which has access by photons. This is when we're receding into the path, so it's condensing. It's projected into the future, so it has an orientation. So this is this structure, if it exists, if my postulates and my theory are correct, through dissonance, much the same way as you would throw a stone into a pool of water, you get ripples. If you throw two stones, you get a place of annihilation, other places of summation. I'm going to create a dissonance in that fabric of space-time, and I'm going to poke a hole the size of the Casimir radius, and I will get out this vital holy force, which is photonic, into my detector. I will expand that, and I will put it into all of my things. And this, 100 years before anybody thinks it's possible, are the things that I can do with this theory. And now I'm at the point, because I just got my equations, I'm going to go off and prove this, and we're going to build these devices. So it's up to you whether you believe it now or wait until you read it in the newspapers or can wear a telecerebroscope on your head. But anyway, that's what I'm doing. Absolute final note is I believe I was foreordained to do this, that I couldn't have done it otherwise. I've been trained since birth. I had my first experience when I was 18 months old. I go into the depths of despair. I don't want to live like I do. This is too hard. And then just when I'm ready to feel I'm going to commit suicide or I'm going to quit, God will give me the next answer. And that's so like a week ago, that equation seems trivial, but I was able to finally finish deriving that equation. So here I am again. Okay, I'll postpone my suicide for a little longer, you know. It's crazy that you would have, I've been given more, you would send than any man. This is the most difficult and oldest question facing. Why would I have this baggage? Why wouldn't I be the most pure, wonderful person, happy, latest, and have all this? But the world is a terrible place. It can be, and the struggle to eat every day, you know, even among this audience, how my main friends, they're almost conscious and immaterial. How am I going to get the money? You can do intellectual, theoretical work with nothing. But now to get the few $1,000 I need to prove this, it's going to be a big uphill battle. But anyway, as Mormons, I hope you got a glimpse of God's universe and how it's going to fit in, and how all of this, because it came from a Mormon, because it's based on Mormon theology, can make Mormon doctrine the central role of human epistemology, because it's going to be able to do everything. And say a couple more things, but I'll shut up.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll try to be very brief so we can save some time for questions here. I too am a philosopher. Let me introduce myself. I should. Start out doing the kind of thing that Richard was talking about in terms of Plato, classical philosophy, and then migrated to the feminism and bioethics, and that's where I'll go next. But I suspect it won't be today. I'm thinking as I listen to this, that philosophers come in various kinds. One of the easiest divides is those who think of philosophy as a kind of science, and those who think of philosophy as more like a kind of literature, a kind of history, a kind of poetry.
pastors, I fall very clearly into the second camp and confess myself quite bewildered by how I began as a philosopher of my variety to even evaluate, much less criticize in any useful way the very complicated and difficult work that Richard has been pursuing on down his own path. Philosophers, the monsters and humans are typical problems. I think the most difficult problem, and that's the kind that Professor Amorosa has chosen to attack, is the problem of consciousness, the problem of other minds. And this is a problem that has been bedeviled us for 400 years. I know that I'm conscious. I'm sitting here perceiving, wallowing in the buzzing perception of being alive in the world and acting in it. But how do I know that you're conscious? You can sit there and perhaps know the person next to you and have every assumption that they have the same experience that you're having. But how about the person on the other side that you don't know so well? What is your reason for believing that person has anything like the kind of experience of the world, the perception and awareness that you have? And how could you prove it, or for that matter, disprove it? Mormon theology. You think that we had a good start on avoiding this. We have a tradition of materialism in the church. We have materialism is not really, I think, a consistent one and not free from its own dualisms and splits. For instance, there's a suggestion that there are two kinds of matter, one smaller than another, so we're materialists in that sense, but there's divisions in and differences across the kinds of matter as well. There's some wonderful twists in here as well, some suggestions somewhere in the Doctrine and Covenants of the identity, the interchangeability, the convertibility of matter and intelligence. The hope that if you have a scientific kind of imagination, the hope that maybe like the equivalence of energy and matter, EMC squared, there might be something along the line of intelligence is matter, C squared, and I believe that this is the direction, this is the sort of provocative hope in Mormon theology that has led Dr. Amorosa down the path that he's taking. But it seems to me that the problem, and this is Descartes' problem, and it's a problem that we haven't got out of yet, it's the problem of the dualism that separates, when you start posing the problem, the mind from the body, that says we have evidence for what the body is, but what's the evidence for what the mind is? And this gap in evidence is something that is intrinsic to the way the problem has been set up. As long as you ask the question in terms that presuppose a gap, a difference between what we experience our own self and our own consciousness awareness and what we see and experience in the world of physical matter, as long as that gap is presupposed in the question, nothing you will find an answer that crosses that gap. The problem of consciousness will still resurface in the form of the problem of other minds. Whatever the relation is between thinking and non-thinking being, consciousness, that participation in the booming flow of life that surrounds us, that absorbs us, that carries us on, that we all know of through our own experience, is going to remain as inexplicable and unimaginable as it ever. Amorosa and I are in different camps, I think. And rather than addressing the details of his complex solution, that capacity, which I couldn't in any case address in 10 minutes, I'd like to instead argue that now that we've solved the problem, maybe you should start out formulating ways of avoiding it. Start out thinking about what his interest is in matters of consciousness or in theology, and figuring out ways to talk about the world in a way which makes it, which both reveals it as it is, but not one which makes it more complex, which creates obstacles to us for our comfortable operation within it. The language of physics that you are using to solve or to address these theological and problems and problems of consciousness is, from the standpoint of a philosopher on the poet's, not the scientist's, side of the divide, not a language that makes the world clearer, that makes it more intelligible to us, or that makes it easier to deal with. And perhaps now that the hard part is done and the equation is solved, the other problems that are associated with that and that drew you to address those problems in the first place can be dealt with more on their own terms. Language is the mirror in which we perceive our world. And I think we need to think, when we address problems, be they theological, problems of consciousness, or problems of physics, is what kind of language will mirror the world best and make it most accessible to us. There's one of the stories that illuminates our lives. There are several stories about mirrors and their use in terms of fighting monsters. There's a nice brief story about the man who was trying to kill a monster that threatened the town, the glimpse of which, the sight of which, the look of which would turn a person to stone. And so his solution, which eventually led him to kill the monster, was to find a mirror in which he could look. So he saw a picture of the monster, but was not subjected to the glare of her eyes, and was therefore able to kill it. There are mirrors as well that reveal the difference between real monsters and fantastical monsters. A monster that terrorized the town, when seen in the mirror, turns out to be just a phantasm, not a real threat at all. And through the mirror, recognized as the illusion that it was. I suppose that what I'm suggesting is that there's a sense in which the language of physics is not a mirror that reveals the truth about matters of consciousness or theology, and that other mirrors may be more useful to us. And I've obviously exceeded the time. I hope that you have a minute or two for a quick question.
I want to do one quick thing. I have applied the model already, and I did this. A lot of work was by direct revelation from God. The theory can explain the origin of sexual preference in scientific terms. It's too politically driven. That's one of the reasons why God asked me to do it. It's out on the table for sale. The book has some problems, but I'm going to rewrite it. Then I have this other book which has a lot of my theory. There's 39 chapters by 36 authors. They're going to give 50% off. If you want more off, come and talk to me. But other than that, some questions.
Thank you.
See me in the hall or whatever. So.